This is an oral history with Florence Bernot, conducted on March 20th, 2013. The interviewer is Crawford Young. Let's start out with the beginning. Florence, could you say a few words about your family background and the influence that it might have had on your subsequent intellectual development?
I can try. Well, of course, you know, the first thing is, of course, I'm from France, so my family is sort of typical French in the sense that it comes from everywhere. So probably for my immediate intellectual curiosity, I would say the history of my paternal family is probably more interesting, or more again directly involved, because my father's parents were pieds noirs, French colonialists in Algeria, and my dad was born in Algeria in 1940. In not very far from Algiers, the name escapes my mind right now, but it's gonna come in a town actually called Sétif. And I think the relationship that I have and he has actually, my father, with Algeria is very complicated and not that pregnant at first sight, because he and his parents left Algeria in 1945 after the war. My grandfather served in the Allied forces. He was an engineer, public works engineer. And so he married a woman from Paris, and I think she didn't feel like, you know, spending her whole life in Algeria or in Tunisia. I think they were refugees in Tunisia during the war. So they left Algeria in 1945 when my dad was five, and it means that they lived through the end of this period, through the end of colonialism and the independence war, you know, in a remote position. So I don't think they basically experienced the trauma of decolonization and the conflict as much as, you know, other parts of the family that stayed in Algeria until 1962, 1963 even. And I always thought that my father's view of Algeria was really strange, you know, growing up, because he was a high school teacher. He was, you know, left-minded, you know, sort of typical, sort of social reformist kind of middle-class French guy. And on the other hand, he was pro-French Algeria, you know, in this kind of completely uncritical fashion. So, you know, I was, of course, probing him all the time. You know, I was a teenager and I was teasing him and my grandfather. And they would talk about Algeria's war of independence as a civil war. And they were, you know, they were really feeling completely straightforward about the sort of positive aspects of French colonization of Algeria. So you know, the clash between his sort of political views and his sort of family history really fascinated me. And I think that was my first introduction to the enigma of colonialism, I guess, you know, and decolonization. So I was intrigued. I felt a lot of fascination for North Africa and Algeria, but it felt really too close to home. And I felt very illegitimate. I still do, you know. I feel like I'm the daughter of, you know, French colonialists in Algeria, and I never talked to people from Algerian descent without, you know, this kind of restraint. And so I think, you know, it took a long time to sort of get ripe in my mind, but after a series of coincidences, I think the possibility of doing research in the Congo looked like the sort of perfect, you know, detour for that. On my mother's side, actually, there's also quite a lot of important aspects that are, you know, more psychological, I think, rather than, you know, sort of very straightforward material kind of circumstances. First of all, my mother comes from a family in the south of France whose her older daughter married a Swiss who became a consul for Switzerland in Algeria. And so my mom would go to Algeria every summer on vacation. I think she always told me her love story with, you know, one of a young landowner in Algeria, French, of course. And she didn't meet my father there. She met him in Aix-en-Provence at the university. But so she had sort of also, you know, youth ties with Algeria. But more importantly, my mother divorced my father when I was 10 or 11. And she remarried an engineer, actually, who she lost the custody of the children, us, my sister and I, which was a big tragedy in my life. And so I had to go with my father at the time, which I was not happy about. And the relevance of that for my intellectual development is that my mother then did not stay in the same town or in the same region. She actually followed her new husband to Martinique in the French Caribbean first, and then to Nigeria. And that fascinated me, of course. You know, it was almost a history of a loss for me. She was not happy at all in Nigeria. So, you know, she would come back for the summer vacation. We would spend the summer with her. But she would never basically pay my sister and I a trip to Nigeria because, you know, that was not very interesting for her. So I think going to Africa was intellectually was maybe at some level, you know, trying to understand the sort of colonial dilemma of my father, which, you know, it's not that nice. It can be also sort of, I don't know how you'd say that in English, but, you know, in sorts of French psychoanalytical term, you can say that a sort of reparation, you know, you repair, you try to do better. So it was very clear for me that going to Central Africa, I was going with a completely different kind of frame of mind, of course. But it was also probably at a very much deeper level that I don't understand, you know, completely. It was also going and meet my mother, who had lost at 11 and who died very young. When I was 26, she was 51 of cancer. So, and I was actually already in Madison, or not in Madison, but in the U.S. So, I didn't see her very much when she, you know, before she died. So there's this, you know, it's this mixture of sort of intellectual things and maybe more, maybe more emotional things, I guess.
Well, you must have done very well in your secondary school since you were admitted to the École Normale Supérieure, which is a highly competitive institution and a breeding ground for the French elite. And your undergraduate degree also came from Paris 7. So you were in both of those institutions at the same time?
Yeah, it's actually to pass the exam, which is a national exam, so you're ranked basically. And they take, the école takes, let's say in history, they take 10 or 12 people out of, you know, several hundreds. What you have to do is after high school, you have to do a 2-year preparation, which is very intensive. It's pluridisciplinary. So you do philosophy, history, geography, French literature, English, I mean, a number of foreign languages, Latin. And I mention it because I'm sure I'm not the only one, but those 2 years are really a turning point. It's, you know, it's like this sort of concentrated intellectual training. I actually went to live with my mother. She was back in France. I went to live with her and do this preparation in the Western France, in Nantes. And I passed the exam the first time I passed it, to my surprise. You know, I was, I don't think I had such a high esteem of my own intellectual potential. And actually when I moved to Paris, I entered into the école. It was a bit of a hard experience because, I don't know, I felt a sort of peer pressure. You know you're in this kind of institution with a lot of history and past. So, you know, it's kind of intimidating. I never felt, and I mean, to this day, I never felt that. I felt that I was a historian by chance. I was doing very well in history. But I think I was lacking, and I still lack, some of the qualities, sort of the founding qualities of historians, such as, you know, erudition, for instance. I mean, the ability of, you know, memorizing a lot, mastering a huge body of knowledge. And in any case, I'm not that excited by, you know, this aspect of history, which is really this kind of empirical, I don't know how to describe it, actually. In France, and I came to realize in the US, it's also a discipline that, pardon the word, but extremely patriarchal. Really, I think among the human sciences, I cannot think of many disciplines that are so dominated by men. And as we say jokingly in France with some of my friends, it's a discipline for the great men. You know, when you think about great historians in France or great historians in the US, what kind of female figure do you have in mind? There's almost none. Now, if you think about anthropology or sociology, you'll find a completely different landscape. You know, you can think about, you know, Margaret Mead and you know, other really founding figures that you wouldn't have in history. So, you know, I mean, there was this gender, you know, we were very few women at the école. It was really dominated by this kind of very, you know, those men who were really posing as intellectuals, I mean, much more successfully than I was, you know. Very erudite, you know. And I was like feeling, again, very banal for faculty and particularly female faculty, like a fraud, you know. I was like, oh. But anyway, I mean, I was okay. Now, the École Normale is a bizarre institution because it doesn't really deliver lectures and seminars. You have to be enrolled in a regular university at the same time where you pass your degree, so, you know, BA, MA, etc. And the École Normale is basically housing you, mm-hmm. although it's a choice. You can live outside, you can live in Paris, and provide you with a salary. So you're considered as a civil servant, and then you owe 10 years of your professional life to the state to repay. But, of course, it provides, you know, these young people. I was 19 when I arrived at Normal with, you know, these enormous resources. And on top of it, you do have one or two courses at the école itself with, you know, fairly well-known people who come and give courses. It's a bit of a blank for me, really, the École Normale. I think all the training, the sort of intense, very solid, analytical and intellectual formation I got was mostly in the 2 years preparation. And later on, when I started specializing in African history, but, you know, for my BA, for instance, I mean, it was this kind of large lecture courses at the Sorbonne, no reading whatsoever. I mean, some of them were really poor, you know, not very good. You know, very descriptive, very narrative. And the only course that I really liked was a course in ancient Greek history. And I think it's actually, you know, in retrospect, it's not by chance. At the time, Jean-Pierre Vernant and Marcel Détienne were classic historians, but they were using anthropological methods to reread religious cults in Greece. And not at all, you know, the kind of very sort of rational, philosophical Greece, but the more archaic Greece, you know, how sacrifices were made, all these kind of things. And that I really liked. And at the end of your BA year, you have to choose what you're going to do for an MA. And I was really lost. I really didn't know what to do. I had not taken a single course in African history by that time. And, you know, I was like, well, you know, the only thing that really interests me would be to try to do Greek history, but I had never taken Greek. I had taken Latin. So I talked to my advisors at the école, and, you know, they were supportive and not that supportive. And then a number of completely bizarre circumstances happened. I had a cousin who was at Sciences Po, you know, Political Science Institute in Paris. And we met for coffee, and he said, oh, you know, Florence, I'm going to the Congo this summer. I said, oh, my God, that's really exciting. He said, yeah, you know, we have this sort of internship. I could go there. Blah, blah, blah. So, you know, we talk, and I'm like, well, I'd love to go with you. And he said, well, yeah, why not? I just started thinking, you know, what could I maybe study there? Is there anything I could do? And he was in contact with, he was going for an internship with a sort of Catholic network. So I started thinking, well, maybe I could get in touch with those people. I had no idea, you know, what I was thinking of. And one thing leading to another, I got to hear about this newspaper in Brazzaville had been founded by missionaries, Catholic missionaries, who were still alive, you know, 40 years later or 30 years later. And I think I contacted them. They were really excited, you know, say, oh, it would be fantastic to have somebody to, you know, we have all the archives of the newspaper, blah, blah, blah. So I started thinking about that, and I went to see one African history professor at the Sorbonne who said, well, you know, I'm not doing this kind of history at all, but if nobody wants to be your advisor, I could be your advisor. Then she directed me to Marc Michel in Aix-en-Provence. And over the phone, he said, oh, yeah, why not, you know. I mean, he was actually, we became very close friends after that, but and we still laugh about it because when I said, hi, you know, Professor Michel, can I, you know, here is, you know, I might be interested in doing my MA thesis on the newspaper. What do you think? He said, oh, no way. You know, I already have a student working on that, so you cannot do it. And then, you know, apparently the student didn't really pursue the idea. So, I mean, to make a long story short, I basically, in a matter of 1 month, 6 weeks, I decided to go to the Congo, spend the academic year there and write my MA thesis. And clearly, you know, I mean, everything sort of came together. It was, I think, one big incentive also for me was that I have a sort of love-hate relationship with archives, you know. Mm-hmm. When I read them, I can become quite entranced by them, but I have also this sort of, you know, I don't know, feeling of dread. Where I have these gigantic boxes of old papers in front of me, and I need to go through them, and it takes forever. And it's just, I was really happy I could go to, you know, an exotic place and blah, blah, blah. So that was really. And maybe to finish on this period, I would just like to say one thing, which is that I was thinking about that lately. I was talking to a sociologist friend of mine in Gabon, and we are talking about our sort of intellectual sort of training. And I was telling him that also my last years of high school were really important for me because it was really the time when I started to play around with, you know, more sort of leftist groups, you know, really militant kind of thing. I remember we created a journal and we were really attached to autogestion group. How do you call it? It's like this kind of fairly anarchical or anarchic, pretty extreme left, you know, movements at the time that prone sort of self-management, you know. And I remember that with those milieus, I spent long hours at a professor of philosophy. And, you know, was really at that time introduced to Deleuze and Derrida and Adorno and, you know, Walter Benjamin. And I was unable to grasp anything about it. I was not even, you know, curious enough to go and open those books. But I guess, you know, it was, I don't know, I think it sort of opened my mind at the same time. And funnily enough, it also helped me realize that I was absolutely not cut out for political activism. And I really realized that, you know, to sort of organize demonstration and do the sort of hard work of, you know, political organizing and propaganda and whatever, absolutely not me. So either, you know, through sheer laziness or inability, I started to embrace the idea that I was better, you know, in front of a desk, playing with ideas, rather than maybe engaging with intellectual life through more, you know, active kind of things.
At some point you came into contact with your major mentor, I gather, Catherine Kukarivu-Dirich, and she apparently had an important influence in your the evolution of your intellectual orientation.
Yeah, she did. She came a little bit late in the history because I did my MA with Marc Michel, who was in Aix, and then I was with Jean de Vis, who was this historian of ancient West Africa. Both of them. So de Vis was at the Sorbonne, so that was, you know, the idea. Jan van Sina knows de Vis very well, and we were talking about that later, you know, recently. De Vis was this kind of typical French mandarin, you know, the kind of very well-known professor with a little sort of intellectual court around him. His seminar was typical French seminar, so he wouldn't really lecture. We wouldn't read any books, but he would have guest speakers, right? And that had nothing to do with my own research, but you had to attend, and, you know, it's a very strange way of training people. And I always marvel, you know, how the French system can actually deliver pretty, you know, adequate intellectuals and researchers, because it's a bizarre kind of training. But so, again, you know, to summarize, I didn't have a lot of connection with Jean de Vis. And so I started looking around. I don't remember how, but I went to see Catherine. People, I guess, told me about her. She was at Paris 7, which was considered as a very marginal place, you know, this kind of May 68 sort of suspicious haven for left-wing, not very conventional scholars. And I went to see her, and immediately I liked it, because I think the first time I saw her, she was having office hours. I think I say that in my interview. You know, there was like at least 30 or 40 people outside her office, all of them African. It was just amazing. It was very irritating too, because I stayed there maybe for 3 hours. You know, the story with Catherine is that she came, you know, she had office hours maybe every other month. And with major French professors, they usually have hundreds, I mean, at least tens of students, if not hundreds. I think Catherine advised more than 120 PhD dissertations in her career. Anyway, so I think Catherine, you know, at some point she spotted me. You know, and she came and she said, "So, who are you? What do you want?" And I said, "Well, I'm, you know, student at the École Normale Supérieure," which was, you know, really conscient boasting. I knew that she would remember me, because, you know, everybody is sort of happy to work with somebody from this elite institution. And I said, "Well, you know, I'm just back from the Congo. I wrote an MA on this newspaper, and I really like to do my prelims or whatever it, you know, the term in front with you." And also, I sat in one or two of her seminars, and those were the exact opposite of De Vis. You know, they were crowded. I remember they were going all over the place in very, very cutting-edge research. At the time, it was all about informal economies and global cities in the South. You know, we're talking the mid-1980s. It was really, really exciting and cutting-edge at the time. I really liked, you know, the ambiance, and I thought, really, this. And Catherine, you know, she worked really with, she has worked with the major African scholars and intellectuals in Francophone Africa today. She always, she was, I mean, for her, the whole thing about doing African studies or history was go to Africa as often as you can, as long as you can, work with African intellectuals, you know, it was really this kind of wonderful connection with Africa that I found really fascinating. And it was not neither romantic nor sort of moralistic, you know, it was a sort of fairly realistic embrace of Africa. I really like that. I came to realize no later than last week, talking with Louise White when she came to visit here, and I was talking to her about, you know, my experience with scholars in the U.S., in my field, and, you know, something that I might talk a little bit about later, which is, I think, something that I cannot completely articulate, but for me is sometimes fairly uncomfortable gender difference, you know, in the ways in which people relate to scholars. And Louise was saying, well, Florence, you're not prepared for that because your advisor was a major senior female scholar, which was really unusual. And so you never, in a way, you know, pass the sort of rites of passage that many women have to do here and come to realize that there will be obstacles, you know, on the road. And it's true that with Catherine, she was fighting all the time with her male colleagues. But again, I mean, I can talk for hours about Catherine. She's an incredibly powerful fighting personality and not aggressive at all, but she, you know, she knows her stuff. She's an extremely good fundraiser, very good organizer. And so she was really able to weigh in the French landscape in African studies in ways that I cannot quite... I don't quite see an equivalent in either the U.S. or Great Britain, let's say. And it's true that maybe it insulated me, you know, from... I think it's beyond that. I think the French system and French men and women can be extremely prejudiced against women, but they are in a very different way than in the U.S. And I think I left France at a moment in my career where probably I would have hit the glass ceiling, proverbial. So I, you know, I might idealize the thing. But in France, the kind of national exams that I talked to you about, all the dissertations, exams, papers that you write in universities are always anonymous. So it's a completely, it's a merit. I mean, it's never perfect, but you know, for normal sub, nobody knew if I was a woman or a man when I was writing my essays. And when I was starting to teach, and I spent quite a few years teaching in universities in France, I never felt that I was treated differently. You know, I would go to lunch with male colleagues, they would ask my advice. Again, you know, I was maybe starting... probably naive, but I could see the difference right away when I came here, and it's very subtle. You know, it's also, of course, to take with a grain of salt. But anyway, whatever, you know, I might have experienced in France, I think Catherine, in a way, sheltered me from that. And intellectually, she was great in the sense that she pushed me during my dissertation. She always helped me, supported me, you know, so provided me with funding, for instance, to do the research group on the prison history. Made me go to Africa all the time, you know. I went to Niger, I went to Senegal, I went to Guinea. all of that, because Catherine was always had funding for me to go and do some different kinds of jobs. But at some point, I think Catherine and I are very different. When it comes to research, I think Catherine is somebody who's more... you know, after she wrote her magnum opus, she became more of a sort of entrepreneur, I guess, intellectual entrepreneur, writing collections and sort of books that would help familiarize maybe a larger public with some topics, you know, African urban history, gender history. Whereas I'm really not attracted by this kind of work. I'm much more attracted to more, to narrower, you know, more research, field research-based kind of history. So that's that, I guess.
So perhaps in implementation of your 10-year obligation to the French state, you did teach in Aix-en-Provence, at École Normale for a time. What memories do you take from those periods of teaching in France?
Well, I think they were good and very nurturing, very intimidating. I was really young. I think I started teaching, I was barely 23. And not as a TA, I was really, you know, in charge of kind of big lecture classes you find here, but it's, you know, like 200, 300 students. It was really scary. And very exciting, too. X was fantastic because it had a very strong African and also Middle Eastern, Mediterranean and North African studies, and especially North African, Maghreb. One of the person I really was working closely with and really helped me was Robert Hilbert, who created the equivalent of the EHESS in Aix for a Mediterranean house for social sciences. So it was all exciting, you know, it was all about colonialism, post-colonialism, you know, the relationship between France and that time I was a bit closer in a way to, you know, Algeria and all that. I was teaching mostly contemporary history. So I was not teaching African history, which is, you know, again, typical for French historians. You specialize in a period rather than in an area. And same at the École Normale Supérieure, it had a lot of limitations, and in a way, I think I had to catch up, really, you know, in the literature on Africa, because it was really hard to prepare those courses, and I had really to read an enormous amount on, you know, I remember at the École Normale, I did a course on nations and nationalism in Europe, you know, from the 19th century to the 20th century, and I was supposed, you know, to regurgitate almost everything to my students who were, you know, Normalian, so they were good. So you can imagine that beyond what I had to read for my dissertation, I was not that up to date with African history. On the other hand, I think it brings probably to my scholarship something different. You know, I might be more prone to, and I think it's a limitation. I think, I don't know if it's a limitation in my scholarship, but it's in the, a limitation in the recognition of my scholarship, because I tend to talk to people who are not in African history necessarily. You know, I talk to people who are doing biopolitics or whatever, you know, history of the fetish. Not in Africa necessarily. So Yeah, I might be digging my grave, as we say in France, but, you know, I don't think I can do otherwise, really. And, yeah, I mean, it was great. I really enjoyed those years. They were difficult, you know. I was already married with my husband. We had already a child. We were commuting back and forth between the U.S. and France. So I spent, for instance, I finished my dissertation in the U.S. I came back to teach in Paris. My husband stayed with my daughter in Madison. I had a fairly miserable couple of years in Paris in a little student's studio, I mean room at the École Normale Supérieure where I was teaching, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. it was not fun.
So your husband was based in the U.S.?
He already had a job in Madison, mm-hmm. and I was offered a job in Paris. I spent a year in Madison with no connection whatsoever to UW, mm-hmm. finishing my dissertation. I was at home writing. And I met Jan Vansina at that point. Uh-huh. Then, the École Normale Supérieure needed a one-year professor, and they asked me if I was interested. So, you know, I took a long time, of course, to decide I would go, which I did, but, you know, my ex-husband, Laird Boswell, and my daughter, who was two at the time, they stayed here. And then the job transformed into a tenure-track job at mm-hmm. the école with a search, and I was hired. And then my husband came to join me because he had a leave for a year. And at that moment, so the second year I was teaching at the école, the job, the position in African history opened at UW. So that's mm-hmm. the... Mm-hmm. But see, I mean, we were leading a fairly unstable life at the time. I mean, it was fine with me, but it was more, I think, the way I spent those 2 years sort of isolated, or at least 1 year isolated at the école. Still, in a way, very intimidated. You know, it was very strange. So I think we were 6 history professors. Mm-hmm. 4 of them were my former teachers. Mm-hmm. I had a hard time talking to them as a colleague, you know. I mean, they were wonderful, but it was very intimidating. So I don't have a very good memory of this period. I mean, besides the fact that it was a very good job. Mm-hmm. I defended my dissertation and almost immediately transformed it into a book with Jean-François Bayard mm-hmm. at Political Science and Cartala, who asked me to publish the book with them right away. Mm-hmm. So it was a very productive time, but personally difficult, I think.
Yes, well, the decision to expatriate yourself is a major one. And so it appears that the family connection was one that was decisive, and or at least played a very big role.
No, I think it was really decisive. Mm-hmm. And you know, I still don't quite know, not sure about the combination of factors. I'll just explain, you know, and I think I really remember that my husband and I were sitting in Paris. We knew the job was opening in Madison. He was planning to apply for jobs in France. You know, he's bilingual, Laird Boswell. He does French history, which would have been a problem. But, you know, and he gave lectures when I was in Aix. Mm-hmm. People, I mean, he had some networks in France. I mean, it was not at all unrealistic to think that he could get a job in mm-hmm. France. So basically, the idea was, let's apply for jobs. And we'll see who gets one, right? I only applied to Madison, by the way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, I guess personally the idea was to sort of finally settle somewhere, right, and raise a family. But, you know, of course I knew Madison had a fantastic African studies program. Mm-hmm. I, even at that time, I knew that I would probably be happier in a large institution, very dynamic, with lots of students, mm-hmm. teaching and researching in African history rather than in an elite, more rarefied place where I would continuously have to teach at least one course a year mm-hmm. on everything but Africa. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, there was a lot of cons, you know. I mean, it was Paris and the École Normale Supérieure, Madison, very good university, but so I guess, you know, I cannot say that the personal thing was, it was decisive, but it was clearly a very important step professionally. Mm-hmm. It was really not neutral. I mean, it changed my career entirely, mm-hmm. I think, you know. I would probably, I don't know what kind of historian I would be today. Mm-hmm. It's really changed everything because I really concentrated on African history. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a very different kind of intellectual emulation. I became much more professional, I think, in African history. I guess I lost a number of things as well. I mean, it's incredibly difficult, actually, you know, mm-hmm. to change the systems, to change your language mm-hmm. in writing, to change teaching strategies. You know, I remember for this anecdotal and, you know, I remember taking anti-anxiety pills for my first mm-hmm. classes. I was so scared. And I was not scared so much because of my knowledge or whatever, but just English, you know. I mean, to have to talk in English for 1 hour was, first few years was really a challenge. Mm-hmm. It's really hard. And plus it's not fun, as you know, I'm sure, Crawford, when you speak in French, however good your language is, you always feel like you're 20% below your sort of best intellectual level. So you feel not that, yes. You know, top. So it's tough. It was tough. Now, you know, it's incredibly beneficial. Yeah. It's incredibly beneficial. I mean, you have learned an enormous amount. The way I write in English, in a way, is very different, much more, I think, straightforward and rational than I do in French, which, you know, French is this poetic language that works a lot with unsaid things mm-hmm. that should inspire you to almost mm-hmm. finish the sentence. In English, you have to put everything there. Mm-hmm. It's a much more rational language, in a way. Mm-hmm.
No, I certainly did share your experience in teaching in French in Congo and Senegal. How would you compare the French university intellectual environment with that in Madison in particular, in this country in general?
Well, I can start with sort of obvious points that I think I developed in the little text for African studies already. One of the things that struck me, and I must say that, you know, I've been here for 16 years now. So, you know, my opinion keep changing a little bit, you know, things that seem at first sight really different, you realize that it's much more subtle than that. what struck me first is that there's a sort of tradition in France that an intellectual builds his or her persona in a confrontational way.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a real intellectual. To me, I mean, that might be my bias, you know, who knows. But I think there's something like that in France. You build yourself by contrast with other people. So you're, I think, constantly looking for creating new concepts, you know, really bringing your mark on the field.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to do so in a different way than mm-hmm. what people have done. And I often explain to my students that you can see that already in the sort of dynamics, classroom dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I was amazed, you know, how sort of collegial
mm-hmm.
and fairly positive and nurturing, again, with plenty of quotation marks, right? Mm. I mean, there's also facade that I think mask, you know, power relations in the U.S. But the ways in which advisors and students, graduate students work in the U.S. seems to me predicated on collaboration, nurturing, you know, stressing the positive things in the students, blah, blah, blah. In France, it's the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're basically almost enemies in the same field. You know, you're a student, you listen to the teacher, even if it's a very famous person, and you say, you laugh, you know, you try to, you have this kind of cynical thing that, I mean, you can be very impressed, but so this kind of confrontational, I think, atmosphere. And, you know, as it's fairly well known, I think, or maybe not, but the way French instructors grade and comment on students' papers is absolutely devastating. I mean, we are used to it, so we don't care. But, I mean, even the best students, the instructor will really stress, you know, the limitation, what's wrong. no, it's hilarious in a way. And so I think, you know, I don't think it's good, actually. I think the American method is probably more productive. But I think the byproduct of that in France is that you sort of sharpen your, I don't know what to call it, you know, your sort of individual.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I sound a little bit like a soldier going to battle, but it's that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's good, I think, because it also emulates people
mm-hmm.
not to be happy with the conventional. And it might be an exaggerated critique,
mm-hmm.
but I often find that there's a lot of rewards in the American system for people mm-hmm. who play by the rules of the game,
mm-hmm.
who rehash what everybody knows already, you know, maybe in a more, you know, elegant way. But how many times have I read, you know, things like, I argue that gender, you know, difference,
mm-hmm.
Is significant to explain this and this and that. And then, you know, it's like, oh, wow, what a scoop. I mean, you know, I'm going a bit too far here, but there's an element of that. That maybe it's my personality and maybe it's this kind mm-hmm. of background. I just find it irritating.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, I mean, when it comes to politics, I find it also sometimes really a bit unsettling to see that, to me, I'm exaggerating again, you know, I was born in Marseille, so we are known for our sort of excessive, maybe judgmental things, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, building careers and recognition...
Mm-hmm.
by basically rehashing, you know, the things that are expected. And again, I'm really simplifying because, you know, I greatly admire many of my colleagues here, and it's really, I say that really honestly, but...
You faced the challenge of having a young daughter while you were starting your academic career. Did you find any difference in that aspect of gender, of the parenting, combining the parenting responsibilities with the demands of the academic profession?
Yeah, totally. It's, again, you don't realize it until you really change countries. In France, everything is done to help women work. You know, it's a natalist policy from the French government that is old now. So to support both women's work, I mean, the sort of integration of women in the labor force and natality, the idea is to really provide a lot of support. So, you know, my daughter in Paris could go to free, excellent kindergarten when she was two, when she was three, right? You have a lot of aid, you know, sort of subvention, blah, blah, blah. So as a result, I mean, one of the obvious results is that in France, many of my colleagues, faculty, female faculty and male faculty have children fairly young. They don't wait. Arriving here, you know, yes, I mean, I was among the few people my age who had kids. I think I arrived here, I was 32, maybe. Yeah, 32. And of course, everything was much harder. You know, you had to pay for childcare. Absolutely no recognition whatsoever. I mean, it's not even that there's no support, there's no recognition. I had my second child here. You know, the department was really helpful. You know, I think I use all my sick leave. It's really outrageous. My husband didn't have to use his sick leave. He couldn't give me half of his sick leave. I had to weather that. And then, still, you know, this was not enough to have a semester off. And so I think the department, you know, created something that I could do without really teaching. And I did well. I had younger colleagues who came and basically taught with their, like, one-month-old baby in the classroom. I mean, this is just outrageous. I mean, in a public university, I think it's actually we are less better off than in corporate companies. I always thought that we should actually do something with my female friends in the history department, and we never came to do it. But that's one of the things that seems quite unbelievable, that this university and this institution has not even zero support. It's like seems to be stranded in the 1930s, you know, even with the rest of the U.S. workforce. So, yeah, that was hard. Not to mention that after I divorced in 2002 to survive on a single salary and raising two kids, and, you know, of course, I have the support of my ex-husband, but it's not pleasant. And again, I don't feel like there's much awareness of that among my colleagues. I think I'm one of the few single people, and even as maybe one of the two single mothers in the department. I don't think there's no. I mean, and I'm not complaining, right? Yeah. I mean, a fairly privileged situation, but that. I mean, thanks for the question, because it's not something, and I don't want to talk about it. You know, also. I see some people who sort of complain and ask for help. I always feel like I want to be considered as a colleague and as a scholar. You know, I don't, just don't want to blame any kind of shortcomings from my family thing. But on the other hand, I would like a little bit of, at least, again, not even concrete support, but a bit of awareness would be really nice. That was tough. Yes, yeah, it's not nice.
Let's talk about your experience in our Department of History. Who were some of your key colleagues? Are there any of the chairs that stand out in your mind in your years here? What are some of the joys and sorrows of being a member of the UW History Department?
I think I can talk probably more collectively. I think, you know, if I want to talk about one person, it would be Tom Spear, because Tom was incredibly supportive when I arrived. And since, you know, from when I arrived to the time he retired, Tom Spear, he was incredibly helpful. He really did a lot of work, gave me credit for some of the work he was doing. Maybe actually did a little bit too much of that. You know, for instance, he organized one large conference, I remember, and, you know, I was co-organizer, but he took care of everything, basically. And it was a bit of a shock, I guess, for me when he left, because the situation really changed. But that was really nice. You know, beyond that, I have mixed feeling about the history department. You know, I can recognize that it's a very good department. It's very, very stimulating. You know, I really enjoy. Mm-hmm. It's rare because we are overworked, all of us. But when I get to know the work of my other colleagues, I really take a lot from it. I'm usually fairly impressed. Mm-hmm. Not always, but most of the time. On the other hand, I feel like I'm sounding like a bitter feminist woman, which I don't think I am, really, but our history department, I think, is quite a bit... It has changed, you know, in the last few years. The social structure of the department has changed enormously. I arrived when it was, to me, you know, still the old guard, fairly conservative, socially conservative, not politically conservative. Mm-hmm. Mostly men, but not, you know, mm-hmm. they have a lot of women allies. Mm-hmm. It has changed a lot, but I think the policies, the sort of governance tradition has not changed. You know, our first female chair was elected 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And one thing, for instance, there's this kind of beer hall kind of old boys still, mm-hmm. I think, patterns, you know. Mm-hmm. And I must say that I care when it, for some reason, you know, mm-hmm. hinder whatever, something I want, you know, or I need. But, you know, I try to be as good a citizen as I can. I probably am not very good. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I work a lot at home. I come to teach, I come to work with my students, but I don't really socialize very much in the department. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I say is, again, to take with a grain of salt. But so I think, you know, there's still this kind of inertia. Mm-hmm. I think there's, maybe to put it simply, I think men feel comfortable with one another, and, you know, they tend to create this sort of informal... Mm-hmm. discussions, mm-hmm. Which are fine. It's just that they don't realize that in practice they do actually mm-hmm. exclude people from the conversation, you know. And yeah, you know, then the other people could do a conversation, but then, I mean, that's mm-hmm. a bit bizarre. There's something I would like to talk about without you know, giving any names or being any personal. But one thing that struck me now in the 16 years is that, because I saw it repeated over and over, there's this funny syndrome in the history department that I call the golden boy syndrome. You laugh, Crawford. Maybe you anticipate what I'm going to say. But, I mean, it's hilarious, yes, to some point, you know. There's this sort of ha-ha moment when the more senior men in the department congregate behind this brand new, young, you know, star material man who all of a sudden in like 1 or 2 years is endowed with all these chairs and, you know, options and resources and big raises and you know, you're on the side and you look and you know, it to me, I've seen 1, 2, 3, 4 I think now it's a bit of a hit and miss. The two first ended up not writing a second book and disappearing in, you know, the back alleys of scholarly brilliance. One of them, you know, I won't say names, but I don't care actually. I was the only one to vote against his retention in this department. Was, I mean, to me, a complete fraud. I mean, it was unbelievable to see how people could congregate behind somebody who had a lot of sort of public qualities, but as a scholar was, I mean, competent is actually generous. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the disproportion between his intellectual and scholarly merit and his institutional achievements were mind-boggling, at least to me. You know, many people sort of advocated for him that he was, you know, he was attracting a lot of students, very true, you know, very, he was very hardworking, always giving talks everywhere. I mean, yeah, I mean, he was. But, I mean, not surprisingly, it was a bit to the detriment of, you know, his production. But that didn't matter. I mean, and so for me it was a bit of a shock because, you know, I mean, my idea of a scholar is, I mean, you try your best to be both a good teacher and, you know, hopefully a good public, maybe, I mean, contribute to the public community, but a large part is also what you work on, you know, what you research and publish about. Anyway, so the golden boy thing is quite funny and quite irritating because, I mean, I have to make peace with it. It's not, I'm not going to change anything, right? But it's bizarre. What can I say?
How about your connections with the African Studies program? How significant have they been for your intellectual career?
I don't know. I mean, it's really important. I mean, I think I'm probably not the only one who takes it for granted. You know, if I imagine that the African Studies program was not around, it would be very bad, you know. I think we could feel, we would feel it right away. Again, I think because of the practical demands of our work, we probably, I mean, thank God we have that, you know, we have the seminars and we have, because, and still, I mean, it's hard to work together, it's hard to, and to work together is the only way to really benefit from one another, you know, you can, I mean, listen to people's talks and read their work or otherwise, I think it's, So I do have, I think, some of my closest colleagues are in African studies across campus. Mm-hmm. But actually, I was putting a little reminder on the list of questions here. I think, and I'm not sure I'm very typical for that, but I have suffered a little bit with the sort of insulation of American campuses. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're wonderful. I mean, the resources you find in African studies in Madison are incredible, right? But I think in France, I was much more directly in contact intellectually with international networks, mm-hmm. in Europe and in Africa. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, throughout my career, I kept publishing a lot in French and participating into, you know, editorial or intellectual projects in French. And so I feel like it, you know, it's like concentric circles, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure that African studies here is maybe as important as the kind of conversation I have with people in, mm-hmm. you know, other universities in the US or in mm-hmm. Africa or mm-hmm. in Europe. And I've tried to build on that institutionally by, you know, we created the Northwestern Madison mm-hmm. Graduate Student and Faculty Workshop, which happens for 2 days every mm-hmm. year. And we have now expanded it to Chicago mm-hmm. University. And I really try to create the exchange program for graduate students with Basel in Switzerland. And I just wrote with a number of colleagues in African Studies an application to the Mellon Fellowship to expand that to mm-hmm. Paris, Oxford, South Africa, WITS, mm-hmm. and Dakar. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, this, the idea is to give graduate students and faculty, you know, eventually a chance to go for a semester, not of research, but really seminar training. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they are also exposed to this kind of international networks because really it's a profession now that, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm an example of that, right? I mean, of, really, I think we are included into this kind of global networks of, mm-hmm. of intellectuals and scholars, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. that's really important, I think, mm-hmm. at least to me.
Let's talk about your major research undertakings. I like very much your
all the interesting things
like
were said in the pose.
Explore some of your major research projects. And the first big one, which I take it probably grows out of your MA work on Congo-Brazzaville, or maybe you didn't.
PhD, dissertation.
On Congo and Gabon in the 1940 to 1965, to covering that very agitated period leading up to independence.
Yes, it's actually a revised version of my dissertation. I guess the publication of this book was a bit unusual because it was in France, and I didn't take 7 years or 5 or 6 years to revise it, which probably would have been a good thing, you know, in mm-hmm. retrospect. But Jean-François Bayard was a member of my committee, and he immediately approached me uh-huh. and said, well, you know, this is really a great dissertation, and I'd love to publish it in my collection at Cartala. Do you think you would be interested? Mm-hmm. And it probably would have to be really trimmed quite a bit. My dissertation was 700 pages plus. And the book is long. It's 400, I think. 500 almost pages. So, you know, really, it took me just a few months to trim it and the book to be reviewed and and published. I, of course, you know, like most people who write a book, I have mixed feelings about it. The positive feelings is that sometimes I really open the book to look at things and I feel, oh my God, I mean, I remember who I was at that time. And I'm amazed that I think many of the things that I said, I would still say them. It doesn't ring wrong to me. And I actually remember that I went to the Congo right after, in 95, right, I mean, right before it, the book appeared. And I was amazed because everything that I had sort of unearthed in the political system, I could, it really helped me understand what was going on in 1995, which I found that incredible. You know, I mean, it was like a sort of perfect illustration that history really helps you read the present. And also, what I like about the book is that I find it much too much political history right now, you know, too factual for my own taste. But I can see already chapters when I was trying to get at something beyond, you know, high politics and really looking at political culture. Of course, the sort of occult spiritual dynamics, but also things like material culture. You know, there's a chapter I like very much about wine and roads and guns, where I was trying to look at the ways in which leaders were relating to their electoral constituency through really the manipulation of those sort of material commodities almost. And so, you know, I can see some of my later interests really sort of sprout in the book. And something that if ever, you know, the book remains for a few more years any relevant and has been, to me, has remained really invisible for most readers, maybe for good reasons. I think it's a book that genuinely tries to look at the political system, not in moral, and not in a moralistic view of race. You know, trying to force a kind of traditional African, pristine, you know, enduring, resisting kind of political culture and a French one, right? But it really tries genuinely to argue that what we see today in terms of political culture and political system is really a combination of the two. And so the book devotes a lot of attention to French colonialists who played a very active political role in, you know, crafting this political system and helping African political leaders. And yeah, I guess, you know, it can be seen as, first of all, completely not interesting, I suppose. It can be seen as maybe a sort of naive, revisionist kind of approach. Maybe it is, you know, I don't feel I wrote it in this kind of perspective. I really tried to look at what happened. And, you know, it was an interesting game of resistance to the French system and an appropriation of the French system, but the French were also really agents there. And I mean, it's a story that continues, you know. I mean, it's hard to explain the political class in Gabon and Congo if you don't see the connection with the French political class. I mean, it's that we like it or not, you know. Mm-hmm. And really, I mean, the book that I write now is fairly different, but it sort of tries to bring these ideas in a different context, much further along, which is the idea that the modern sort of spiritual beliefs and, I mean, fairly deep social values about power and agency. Of course, you know, there's a sort of historical African element into it, but it's really combined in a very intimate way with a European one. And of course, maybe my main argument that I think is not at all articulate in the first book is that then I actually question the differences between those two sets of values. And I think what I'm working on now is to show that they were probably much more compatible and proximate than the sort of racial discourse was telling us. And that, in turn, you know, has enormous consequences for the ways in which we look at the colonial encounter. Mm-hmm. Because if the colonial encounter is not only a combining of different things, but a sort of difficult and transgressive and painful, reflective kind of things, then I think we have to rethink, you know, the idea of domination and cultural innovation. I mean, I'm not saying that it's just that, but I think it's an element that probably has not been looked at very much. And I think it is in Democracy Ambiguë, because precisely maybe my naive and maybe my reformist or maybe my whatever conservative views that, you know, I look at European agents and African agents pretty much as they are, not as saying, oh, those are really good and entitled to being what they're doing because they are, of course, in their own country, which I believe, of course. I mean, I'm not at all justifying French colonization. I think colonialism is a disastrous event, really, for everybody. But I think I was trying to look at those things in a fairly maybe flat, maybe too flat, way.
It picking up on the cultural, the underlying cultural issues that were bubbling under the surface of the political history that you covered very well in the book. Your major work now in progress picks up issues like witchcraft, which by and large political scientists, historians have left strictly to anthropologists to try and unravel, since they don't easily lend themselves to the highly seemingly rationalist analytic that is employed in most of the social sciences. How did you follow that pathway into a much more complicated universe of phenomena?
You put that very well. I should enroll you, Crawford, to write my introduction or the blurb to my book. First of all, I mean, it's true what you say of political scientists, but of course, I want to spell the name of my wonderful colleague Michael Schatzberg, who is one of the few who probably feeling very lonely tries to change the trend here. It's also, I mean, again, you know, in Francophone African studies, political scientists are much more, you know, engaging with this issue. And the book started Really, first of all, because again, democracy is ambiguous. I discovered really and tried to make sense. I didn't try to make sense. I tried to see how it worked. Again, the sort of underside of politics, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's these notions of power that were, you know, really, can be defined by witchcraft or sort of occult agency. And it just coincided with the rise of witchcraft studies after Peter Geshir's book in 1995 in France, in French, mm-hmm. and then 1997, The Modernity of Witchcraft. So then I started, of course, to talk with these people who were, you know, good friends. And then I guess, remember my conflictual and confrontational personality, which is not mine, but only, but the French kind of background. You know, my first reaction was like, it was really interesting to hear about witchcraft, but of course, my reaction was like, but I mean, they talk about witchcraft, but how this notion itself, you know, had come to life or to be used. So what do we know about this notion in, you know, throughout the last 100 years? Mm-hmm. So that was one thing. For the anecdote, I also remember after my book was published, I was in the archives in Aix. I looked precisely for a number of files on, I think it was witchcraft trials or something. And I mean, basically, it was like, if I want, you know, next book, many years of research and writing, honestly, what interests me, that excites me, you know, witchcraft, cannibalism. I mean, it is a very, I guess, ethnocentric and maybe exoticizing thing, but, you know, you have to play with your passion. So, I mean, there was clearly, you know, I divorced at that time from political history, mm-hmm. which, you know, I liked at the time, but I find it's hard, you know, it's, to me, very factual. You cannot do away without a lot of facts and details. And I was joking with Louise White again 2 weeks ago that she did the exact opposite. You know, she started with cultural history and social history, mm-hmm. Louise White. Mm-hmm. She started with cultural and social, and now she's much more into political history. And mm-hmm. I don't think I could write a book like Democracy is Ambiguous again. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's not what attracts me anymore. Mm-hmm. So it was, first of all, the sort of slight irritation, let's say, in those kind of global conversation of knowing nothing, and sort of, you know, I mean, the sort of casual assuming from anthropologists and political scientists that they could really well describe what witchcraft was and what it meant, mm-hmm. To simplify, you know, the sort mm-hmm. of engaging of Africans with sort of late capitalism, mm-hmm. and new political and economic mm-hmm. inequalities, mm-hmm. or, you know, the sort of survival of ways. But it was obvious for me that the colonial period must have really played an enormous role. Mm-hmm. So that was the beginning. And then, so I think I dealt with that in a recent article where I actually tried. It took me years of work for not such a big result, actually. Years of work to trace the lexical, mm-hmm. linguistic shift or aggregation, actually, of vernacular terms with mm-hmm. sorcery, witchcraft, and fetishism. And actually, in this article, I take up a little bit with Peter Geshir because he mm-hmm. completely leaves aside fetishism, which is one of the key repertoires for mm-hmm. witchcraft in French and in English. Mm-hmm. And it has its own meaning and its own genealogy. And he also, as you know, he doesn't talk at all about other religious systems, and in particular Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So the other irritation was I started to realize that witchcraft and modern witchcraft studies started to take this kind of life of its own,
mm-hmm.
but a little bit unrooted or uprooted from mm-hmm. other forms of
mm-hmm.
spiritual agency.
Mm-hmm.
Now the problem began because I was not interested anymore in witchcraft. I was more interested in the sort of building blocks
mm-hmm.
of what sort of lied, you know, here, mm-hmm. which is much more complicated and to me much more interesting. So then, you know, it became what I call, and yet have to define, the sacred.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, my work now is trying to explore the sort of practical conversation from the 1880s to mm-hmm. the present. That mostly Europeans and Africans and of course, within those groups as well, right, had about, you know, some of the basic elements of,
mm-hmm.
let's say, the formula of occult mm-hmm. agency. So where is it located, this agency? Mm-hmm. Is it material or immaterial?
Mm-hmm.
And how did colonizers and Africans started to discuss those divide between material and immaterial,
mm-hmm.
visible and invisible, tangible and intangible. And of course, I mean, there's also issues of physicality, you know, the thingness of power and the problem of representation as well. So it's not that I have to do it, but I'm really interested in looking at these problems of how even, you know, the Western mind has come to understand
mm-hmm.
how power functions, you know, by symbols and signs and also concrete mm-hmm. force. I said, what is that, you know? So all these things, of course, were really upset in the colonial situation.
Mm-hmm.
By a game, again, of recognition that maybe this was not that different from mm-hmm. African ideas, and yet, mm-hmm. you know, this enormous effort at mm-hmm. differentiating the two. And of course, for me, the big moment, the big turning point was to start really thinking more systematically about the ways in which Africans were considering the body as, I mean, in Equatorial Africa, as a place for mm-hmm. where people, but also, I mean, people can shelter kind mm-hmm. of substance,
mm-hmm.
power substance. But this power substance it's not an organ.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something that can travel between spirits and ritual experts and charms.
Mm-hmm.
And by looking at the ways in which colonizers took care of their body, especially after death, and had, you know, to make it, you know, to say it bluntly, had fairly fetishistic ideas about
mm-hmm.
the value of a dead white body,
mm-hmm.
I started really, I guess, to take the human body as a place where I could really mm-hmm. look at these
mm-hmm.
conversation and debates, and of course how those notions transformed,
mm-hmm.
mutually transformed each mm-hmm. other. So I hope I sound excited, because I am excited, you know, by this research. Again, it's a little bit, I mean, I can be frustrated sometimes because I feel like what I'm doing doesn't fall into any yeah. ready-made
uh-huh.
sort of disciplinary
mm-hmm.
category even in African history, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when people talk about the body in African history, it's mostly for, you know, politics of sexuality or mm-hmm. gender or Mm-hmm. Even, you know, Lynn Thomas's work mm-hmm. on technologies, cosmetics. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm looking at a bit of a different kind of thing, and I really don't know if that has any purchase in the kind of questions historians talk about today. And I must say that it's surprising and kind of it's nice for me, but it's mostly anthropologists who are more interested in my work.
Yes.
And I'm not a good anthropologist, you know, I'm mm-hmm. a sort of self-read anthropologist. So I'm not sure I'm very good at doing what I'm doing, but anyway. I was just printing my manuscript for my 5-year post-tenure review, mm-hmm. and it looked a bit better than I hoped.
Good.
You know, I'm almost there with the first draft, and next year, hopefully, I have a year in residence at an mm-hmm. institute where I can actually do the major intellectual work. You know, now that everything is laid out, I need to mm-hmm. tighten the argument. And mm-hmm. But I can already tell you that I would be very surprised if this is not slowly turning. I mean, what's bubbling under the surface of this mm-hmm. one is mm-hmm. probably ideas of representation and fetishism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, something that I'm starting to work on mm-hmm. with articles. It's in the air, of course, but, you know, I'm really interested in seeing theory, you know, theories of matter. Mm-hmm. And the intellectual concept of fetish is really mm-hmm. interesting because it's at the center of those conversations about mm-hmm. materiality, representation, mm-hmm. you know, transcending material representation, which is really one of the core debate between, let's say, Africa and Europe, I mean, since the 15th century. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised. And again, that excites me. I taught a seminar on African art from the primitive to the global, which was... Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm sorry to keep rambling here, but in a way, I think I'm also testing the economic history. Mm-hmm. Because when you start talking about art and fetish, well, you have to talk about value. Mm-hmm. And the assigning of value, mm-hmm. either economic or social, mm-hmm. is of tremendous importance mm-hmm. during colonialism. Mm-hmm. So I have to get myself a bit better read in, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, not true and blue economic history, but this kind of political economy. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where I'm slowly starting to go, I guess.
Well, it's an enormously challenging subject, and to reduce the complexities of these multiple cultural trends that are weaving together and separating and so forth is to find a language that captures it effectively. It's just an enormously difficult task. Well, another recent theme in your scholarship is questions of post-colonial ruptures and the impact of post-coloniality on the metropole itself and on issues of immigration and so forth in France and elsewhere in Europe. Could you say a few words about that line of work?
Yeah, in a manner of joking, I would say that, you know, it's back to the family romance, of course. I'm back to my guilt trip, of course, with North Africa. Well, yes, you know, part of it is that, but I was not particular. I mean, of course, I do colonial and post-colonial studies. Of course, I'm interested in that. I read a lot in colonial theory. And again, I mean, maybe that a stupid thing to say for my own good reputation, but, you know, I tend to see myself a bit more of a colonial historian than an African historian. And believe me, I genuinely try to put as much African expertise and ground things in Africa, but ultimately, I also don't quite believe in, you know, African history. Of course, how can I, you know, I keep linking it to something else. I mean, maybe it's very colonialist, but what can I do? So, you know, I mean, the interest in colonial history was one thing, and to give you a bit of a context here, in France, when I was doing African history and teaching, we were all sort of lamenting that we were really in a sort of completely marginalized field. I mean, it's well known that in France, academia has not caught up with the colonial past in France. It's not taught. You know, it was not written about at that time. Okay, fine. I leave for the US. I'm happier actually here because there's a lot of post-colonial theory and blah, blah, blah. And I find it really quite interesting. And happens the riots in France in 2005. And, you know, I'm like everybody else. I hear about it. I start looking at the news. I'm really upset. I'm upset because, you know, I not that I feel like I've been around people, faculty, or people in my generation that are from immigré origin. Far from it, precisely because there are very few. I don't think I mean, the late Minister of Justice, you know, this Rachida Dati, she was actually in the same high school I was. She was completely invisible to me. I mean, that tells you something. I was probably, you know, I was in an industrial town in Burgundy. There were probably many of these people, but they were invisible to me. You know, it was like in the 1970s and 1980s, they were probably, you know, working class people that I would not befriend. And very few of them have made it. My generation, you know, in their 40s and 50s, have made it to university positions. So I'm not trying to romanticize my sort of, you know, link to that, but as sort of regular leftist, you know, whatever. I mean, you couldn't live in France without finally being aware, you know, in the 1990s at least, of incredible tensions and incredible, really injustice, you know. And so, you know, I saw the riots, and to me, this was really a political movement. I mean, maybe it was not expressed in a regular political discourse, but it was clearly, you know, a way of expressing a very difficult situation, very unfair situation. Okay, so that's a more, you know, maybe psychological or emotional side of it. But on the other hand, maybe wrongly, I thought, well, I mean, people started among the rioters and among the more political, you know, intellectuals to talk about the natives of the Republic, you know, start this sort of political association, claiming that the minorities in France had this kind of historical connection because of their origin and because of colonialism. Seems to me pretty obvious. And at the same time, you started to have the black movement in Paris as well, which was sort of, you know, claiming a more racial form of identity and trying to put a race as a category of analysis, you know, on the floor. And my reaction was, not only why not, but, you know, it's sort of, it's time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, clearly, I think my years in, my 10 years at that point in the U.S. had really changed me. Mm-hmm. I think I came as a sort of French universalist person, mm-hmm. to become, you know, to becoming really aware of the, of how race and yeah, you know, minority can be really obscured by this kind of discourse. So, you know, I start, of course, talking with many people, including Catherine Cochry, and Catherine was incredibly active. So, you know, she was emeritus at the time, but she was still going to all sorts of seminars. And she worked a little bit as a steering house, almost, mm-hmm. between, you know, famous African intellectuals like Mamadou Diouf and Achim Mbembe, who were constantly mm-hmm. reacting about the riots. People like me, you know, sort of younger Africanists, people that she had trained, some people in Africa were actually apparently very surprised by what was going in France. I mean, it's actually the most resistant people to the sort of race and colonial explanation of the riots were people in Africa. It was really strange. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and then I realized within a few weeks that the majority of my colleagues, I'm talking about people who were graduate students with me, mm-hmm. are all siding with the reaction of the French government and the sort of conventional academic milieu saying, oh my God, this is really an enormous risk for France. It's really not a good idea to talk about these riots in terms of race and colonialism. We are ethnicizing the social question. We mm-hmm. are dividing these people from their class interest. Mm-hmm. This is a disaster. You know, the French model might not work very well, but we have to make it work better. Mm-hmm. I was like stunned. I was like, come on, I mean, on an intellectual level, we finally have the expertise, you know, and some kind of ways of discussing this. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying we should talk for the people, mm-hmm. not at all, but, you know, I mean, if we have something to say, it's for me, it's certainly not to say, oh, yeah, you know, the wonderful French melting pot. Mm-hmm. Let's certainly not talk about the fact that these people might be the victim of colonial stereotypes. It was really strange. And through Catherine, I came in touch with people I knew but not, you know, I'd never worked with. A sort of association that was quite marginalized from academia. So almost a sort of private enterprise of two young historians, three young historians who had already published a book called The Colonial Fracture, mm-hmm. precisely denouncing the sort of ignorance of the colonial mm-hmm. past, and also more than ignorance of the colonial past, ignorance of the legacy of colonialism in France, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. to me was really crucial. Mm-hmm. And believe me, the book was a scandal. Politique Africaine had a full dossier criticizing it. So, yeah, I know, it's very surprising when you look from the US. So there's enormous resistance. And again, with, you know, fairly enlightened, fairly intelligent mm-hmm. Africanist scholars. I'm not talking about, you know, mm-hmm. sort of right-wing mm-hmm. French historian, no. So basically, we decided to publish his collection, and as a sort of manifesto to say, look, I mean, not everything is good in post-colonial studies and colonial studies, but we argue that it's actually very useful, you know, to look at France also in terms of the ways in which the French political and social systems have still not come up to terms with this kind of legacies of mm-hmm. racial stereotypes, of historical stereotypes, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, I would never claim that I'm a specialist of, you know, social issues and mm-hmm. ethnicity in France. But I think I'm not completely out of my mind when I think I can't talk about mm-hmm. colonial discourses. I mean, mm-hmm. I've studied them mm-hmm. in Africa for a long time. And I can't see them in France. I mean, it's not very difficult. I mean, far from it. So anyway, I mean, probably the main professional little skirmish here is that I wrote a chapter in this book that was pretty frightful for me to write mm-hmm. and was a sort of direct attack on Jean-François Bayard.
Oh, really?
Who, now I guess you guess, put himself on the side of the more universalist people. And, I mean, it's... Jean-François is somebody I like very much and I find extremely intelligent, and I praised, you know, his role in really reviving African studies in France. So, I mean, and my opinion hasn't changed. But for this particular thing, he really led the attacks. Mm. And he led very personal attacks on this group of friends, you know, mm-hmm. saying that basically they were profiting from immigrants, that they were a sort of corporate business enterprise that was making money out of this thing. All of that without saying any names. And also then launching a huge intellectual attack on postcolonial studies.
Mm-hmm.
To simplify, saying that they had invented nothing. French theorists had already done everything mm-hmm. needed to mm-hmm. be done. And I don't know, I think my, as you say, we say in French, my blood just make a full turn in 1 second. I decided, well, no, I can't let you say that. And also, you know, he was actually targeting some people. I think he had in mind Achille Mbembe, actually. Mm-hmm. But he was also saying things, I mean, literally. And all these French expatriates in U.S. universities who need to give guarantees to their institution by reading and adopting the viewpoint of postcolonial studies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was pretty powerful attack.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, I thought, again, no names, no personal, sort of allusion, and then a sort of intellectual critique of all the points in postcolonial studies.
Mm-hmm.
So, I wrote an article that where I decided to do the exact opposite,
mm-hmm.
to read what he was saying, because I argue that he has not read postcolonial studies.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of, to me, he built a sort of straw man,
mm-hmm.
you know, to sort of destroy it. So I read his text very carefully, and I talk about him, I mean, as an author, of course, not as a person. And part of the attack for me is also that Jean-François, I mean, his tone to me is incredibly paternalistic, and also, in particular, saying that historians of colonialism or postcolonial studies, especially, they tend to dehistoricize colonialism. You know, mm-hmm. they take it as a whole,
mm-hmm.
and then they apply it in France as if nothing has changed, and blah. So basically, it's sort of lecturing me on my discipline, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I adopted a mocking tone, but, you know, to basically say, well, Jean-François, you know, you can basically sweep your door before sort of coming and telling me what I should do as a historian and the kind of stupidity I don't see when dealing with the colonial past. So I don't know why I'm saying that, but I mean, I thought I had to publish it, you know. I thought, well, it's not going to help me in France if I ever go back, do any kind of career in France. It was a fairly personal attack, you know, it reads as that. I mean, it's intellectual, it's not about him. And again, I think basically the gist of it is that I felt really that I felt legitimate in intervening in this debate. Mm-hmm. And I was really disappointed to see, again, Africanists recuse themselves, in a way, from this debate. Mm-hmm. I mean, I respect their opinions, but precisely, I also think that there are very much opinions. Mm-hmm. I don't think they read postcolonial studies. I think they work with stereotypes mm-hmm. more than, you mm-hmm. know, real engagement with those texts. Mm-hmm. So I ended up writing this chapter and then, you know, co-editing the collection and also writing a chapter in English, mostly on the indigènes de la République, the natives of the République, mm-hmm. which fascinates me because it's precisely a movement that is incredibly historical. Yeah. So it builds a sort of political constituency around history rather than race, which mm-hmm. I find fascinating. Mm-hmm. So that's that. I mean, you know, I guess I don't see myself as a historian of France or historian of French colonialism, but if anything, I think it's good that, I mean, maybe it's imperialist and naive and mm-hmm. whatever, you know. But I see it as also a way of de-ghettoizing. I do think that historians need to be engaged. I mean, again, I gave up long ago on direct political activism myself. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to be political in a sort of judgmental way, but mm-hmm. I do think that what we write, even in history and even about the past, is really important, you know? I mean, it's not just knowledge. It has some bearing on a number of big, big, big contemporary debates. And I would feel cowardly if I didn't uh-huh. interfere. Now, you know, maybe we'll see, you know, maybe it was not such a good idea. Yeah. And maybe I'm outreaching myself, I don't know. But mm-hmm. but that's something I would, for instance, really remind students about. I mean, mm-hmm. I feel I'm very contradictory myself. You know, I'm somebody who is very much for the ivory tower. Mm-hmm. In other words, my call is not to write for undergraduate students. Fine, you know, if you do that, but also yeah. please don't tell me that scholars have to do that. Yeah. All of them, no. I don't think so. I think our knowledge makes progress only if you push the envelope in fairly, you know, obscure and difficult to grasp ideas. Mm-hmm. You cannot do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and on the other hand, I still think having a sense, not engaging for such and such ideology, but having mm-hmm. a sense that what you're mm-hmm. writing has some kind of mm-hmm. weight, I think, mm-hmm. for me is important. Mm-hmm.
Any final thoughts on future directions? Or anything that we've failed to explore in this.
We didn't talk about research funding and support, but yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the big, really the big assets for me in my career coming to UW. Mm-hmm. Here, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying it's perfect. Mm-hmm. you know, I can lament like anybody else, you know, the lack of support for the humanities and things, but still, you know, what I really like is also that it funds individual research and individual projects. Mm-hmm. I mean, UW, you know, extramuros, foundations. And I can see in Europe that they are going down a path that to me is really counterproductive. They try, I think, to regenerate research and the standing of universities in Europe mm-hmm. by what they think is imitating the US, mm-hmm. meaning that they give this enormous research funds. Mm-hmm. So we are talking like 5 million euros to a single, you know, project, mm-hmm. How do you say, sponsor, coordinator. And they do that on the model of hard sciences. Mm-hmm. So what they do is they think that you or me, let's say, I'm going to have a, you know, a team of graduate students and assistants and blah, blah, blah. And then we'll end up with having a very groundbreaking collection. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. You know, I think that's a very ill-defined purpose. It's a huge waste of money. I mean, if you give me 5 million euros, I will not write a book. I will waste my time, mm-hmm. I don't know, playing the coordinator, organizer of, you know, three of... I mean, some people do that very well. And yes, in some cases, you arrive at groundbreaking things. Mm-hmm. But I really deplore that the sort of middle ground research funds is sort of drying up. Mm-hmm. And I think the US have been very clever in that. I mean, you still can get substantial funding mm-hmm. for, again, you know, sort of monographs or really mm-hmm. sort of groundbreaking project mm-hmm. In a way without having to jungle with this sort of overblown mm-hmm. Research funds. So that I really appreciate. Mm-hmm. And it's helpful. I mean, of course, the downside is, again, I think sometimes the university or the department tends to fail. I'm sure mm-hmm. it's not a new thing, but it's also mm-hmm. irritating, you know. I mean, it's not the same thing going to the Congo and Gabon every other year, you know, for mm-hmm. 6 weeks. In terms of cost and in terms of risk than going to the archives in Washington, D.C. And yet, mm-hmm. I don't feel like I have access to mm-hmm. any additional support and maybe not much recognition, you know. Mm-hmm. And I do, I mean, I really try to continue going very often. So, you know, I've been going since 1998, every other year almost. Mm-hmm. And a large part of... I mean, I couldn't write the way I write without that. Mm-hmm. It's not so much that I do... I do, of course, oral research, but it just keeps me in contact with mm-hmm. ideas, but also in contact with African scholars. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's absolutely precious. And I think I don't see that with my friends, actually, you know. I mean, my colleagues in the U.S. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of contacts with informers. Maybe I'm very lucky, because in Central Africa, you have really brilliant scholars. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, they don't fit the model of, you know, mm-hmm. they don't publish that much. But mm-hmm. in terms of, I mean, their creativity, some mm-hmm. analytical views, I mean, it's mm-hmm. really excellent. Mm-hmm. And also one of my favorite projects, I hope I will live to see it, is that, again, you know, trying to maybe flatten out or de-ghettoize African history. My dream is that research funding will also be given to African scholars to study mm-hmm. something else than Africa. And really, I think it would mm-hmm. be so wonderful. Mm-hmm. wonderful to have African scholars looking at the political system in France, to come to the US and look at material culture in the US, or witchcraft in the US, or UFOs in the US. You know what? And it's sad because the research, I think, tends to be channeled, you know, really north to south. Or, you know, when it's sort of horizontally or vertically channeled, oh, you're an African scholar, so you should work on Africa. No. I think that would, it seems to me, again, I may be naive, and maybe I don't see the downside of it, but it seems to me it would really do a lot more in terms of promoting really, you know, sort of uplifting of African universities and institutions too. But that might be a dream.
Thank you very much. This concludes an oral history with Florence Bernot.